Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. We are here on a Tuesday. This week, Tuesday, October 3rd, 2017. Not doing a Monday show this week. Instead of recapping week four of the NFL season, we're going to recap the first quarter of the NFL season and maybe look ahead towards the rest of the season to come. And joining me to do that is ESPN writer Mike Sando. Mr. Sando, how are you?
Good to be back. Love it.
Thank you. My dog decided to move around in her bed the moment we started recording this podcast after sleeping soundly for the last several hours. So, of course, perfect timing here on my end when it comes to dog interruptions of the show.
I got to tell you, we got three Boston Terriers, and I work from home, and I'm constantly on the phone with personnel people around the league, and these dogs snore. sometimes I just have to disclose, I'm like, okay, is that close enough? Does the guy think, like, you know, I'm in a where would I be where someone's snoring? I mean, I'm totally unprofessional, but that's the way it is. It's dog life, you know?
It is dog life. It's true. I don't know. I'm lucky. My dog does not snore too much. She'll occasionally, if she's very tired, there'll be an occasional snore, but mostly she's pretty good. Today we're going to get to a few things, sort of recapping, like I said, the first quarter of the year, hitting on some points from that, and then getting to maybe figure out who's going to break out and who's going to, who the rest of the season really matters to in some ways. But let's start with this. I wrote about the surprises in the NFL through the first quarter of the season. Definitely a really fascinating beginning to the year. A lot of teams who we would expect to be dominant, not playing so well. And the best team in the league, the one undefeated team left in football, is the Kansas City Chiefs, which I don't think anyone saw coming heading into the season. So let's start there, Mike. In terms of the Chiefs, obviously I don't think anyone, given that they played the Patriots to start this season, would have expected that Kansas City would have started the year 4-0. But how surprised are you in terms of how they're performing?
A little bit. You know, I think my criticism of them in the offseason was that they just seemed to stand pat, that, you know, their move with Patrick Mahomes was clearly for the future, maybe at the expense of the present. And meanwhile, here was New England hustling and making all these roster moves. But early in the year, all that hustling can work against you. You know, I think Bill Belichick would tell you, maybe not during his press conference, but if you got him off to the side, he might tell you that September is really the new preseason. It's hard to prepare a team. And so the biggest fear for New England was you're adding all these new parts, and how quickly can they come together? You almost need the season to start happening. And in Kansas City, by standing pat, it almost works, you know, to your favor early in the year. I know Kareem Hunt's been a nice discovery and a newcomer, but that's a position where you can plug guys in. And, this is really largely the same team they've had for a long time, with established schemes, both sides of the ball, and players throughout their roster. So maybe they're a little bit easier to be in midseason form. And now they've won a couple close games, too, that could have gone either way. So I always think you look at the first four games, you can find teams, you know, suddenly it's like, hey, the Giants have played a bunch of games on the road. Well, no wonder they have a bad record on top of their problems, you know.
Right.
That's part of it, too.
Do you, obviously, 1.3% chance per the Football Power Index of the Chiefs going 16-0, very unlikely. But even with that saying, they're going to go 16-0. I mean, do you think the Chiefs are going to be playing at this level over the course of the entire season?
No. I mean, I think a lot of times, you know, a team like them, they've already lost, you know, Eric Berry, and I think there will continue to be some attrition to them. And I think also when you get to the playoffs, you know, teams are better prepared for you. And I think that's going to be their issue in the end is, you know, they do as good a job of anyone as, you know, borrowing plays from the college ranks and scheming and getting, you know, finding ways to use their wide receivers and tight ends creatively to mask their weaknesses. But in a playoff game, you're still going to probably have to beat Tom Brady, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's why they drafted Patrick Mahomes. Not that he's going to do it this year, but in the future, you know, that could be it.
Yeah, I mean, they beat Brady once, but it's tough to do that twice in a season. Not many quarterbacks certainly have. The thing with me that I'm concerned about with them, and it's coming up more and more, is the offensive line, which is beat up. I mean, they're a team that it's invested pretty heavily in their offensive line. They draft well, and they put an emphasis on acquiring offensive linemen. But you're looking at a line now where Mitch Morris, the center, is hurt. Eric Fisher, their starting left tackle, was playing through a back injury. He isn't 100% and was honestly a surprise to play Monday night. Parker Erringer, their starting guard last year, has missed the entire season so far. And yesterday, Lauren Duvernay-Tardif went down with an injury. It looks like he may be out for at least a couple weeks, if not more. So you're down several offensive linemen there. And you saw that at times during last night's game where Alex Smith was getting beat up in the pocket. And at the beginning of the year, if you can protect Alex Smith, he's going to do a lot of things, and the running game is going to be very effective. But with more injuries up front there, any team's going to struggle, let alone a team that relies so much, like you said, on continuity and relies so much on sort of working as a unit as the Chiefs do.
No doubt. And in that division, if you know, you got to beat Denver too. And so that matchup, you know, with their rushers could be, you know, those injuries could help to swing that. I do think that they do a nice job with their scheme of covering for their weaknesses. So I give them some ability to do that. I think everyone's got line problems too. You know,
that's the other part of it. Is
teams in the league that would love to have the Chiefs line problems, actually.
Yeah, that's totally fair. Some of them in the NFC West, you might say. One team, though, that doesn't have line problems so far, a team that's been incredible on offense, too, I think a lot of people surprised, the Los Angeles Rams, who brought in Andrew Whitworth before the season, and he figured they might be a little better. Sean McVay was going to, you know, work with Jared Goff, who looked awful last year, and Todd Gurley, who was and also ran running back last year, and suddenly they look like one of the best offenses in football. So, again, no one could have seen this coming, but how surprised are you relative to what your expectations were about how much they might improve into the McVay's first season during the offseason?
They're by far my biggest surprise. You know, I had a conversation with a coach this morning, and I was like, oh, you know, I'm trying to self-scout here. Did I blow this? Should I have seen this? And I said, is this a case of sort of, you know, the exciting new coach coming in, and they get a bump out of it, but the underlying problems that were there before, you know, rise to the surface eventually and are still the reason why this team's not very good? And coach kind of played devil's advocate. He goes, well, what were the problems? And so when you look at what the problems were, you know, obviously offensive scheming was a big one that I think McVay has fixed. I think they're good in that area. Offensive line, well, they got two, you know, veterans there to shore it up. They have the oldest starting offensive line in the league, which can be a bad thing, but it can be a good thing when mm-hmm. you're trying to not have Jared Goff carry the leadership mantle for the team. You get some stability. You calm things down. Todd Gurley, who's not a great creator on his own but can really make the most of running lanes, now has some. Goff has settled down. Goff was a problem. Well, weapons were a problem on offense. Well, Kayvon Austin has gone from maybe being their best weapon at wide receiver to maybe their third or fourth best. You know, they acquired Sammy Watkins. They have Robert Woods. They hit on the draft, it looks like, on Cooper Kupp. So the things we thought that were there that were really going to doom them maybe were solved. And so, you know, maybe they're just going to be way better than I thought. I looked at them glass half full, you know, as opposed to glass half empty the whole off season, and maybe I was just totally wrong.
No, I mean, I mean we were both wrong if that's the case. I definitely was very skeptical. You know, even expecting some improvement, seeing this, I just could not have fathomed it. So the schedule gets tougher. I mean, there's going to be some games down the line where we're going to see, you know, we're going to see what the Rams are made of as the season goes on. But, you know, playing the Cowboys, I don't think anyone expected them to beat the Cowboys last week, and that's exactly what happened. So McVay deserves a ton of credit. Elsewhere, on the other side of the league, think about the AFC East, a division where we all kind of had it in our heads as to what the division was going to be like come week one. The Patriots are going to be a dominant team. The Dolphins were, even if you thought the Dolphins maybe weren't going to be as successful as they were last year, you know, they were going to be on the fringes of the playoff picture. The Bills were tanking, and the Jets were the Jets. And now, 4 weeks into the season, it looks totally different. The Bills are in first place with one of the best defenses in football. The Patriots are 2-2. The Dolphins are 1-2 and a missed field goal away from starting 0-3 with two shutouts or two near shutouts in a pair of weeks against the Jets and the Saints. And the Jets are 2-2, which I don't think anyone saw coming. So let me ask you, of those four, which is most surprising to you through the first quarter of the season?
I guess the biggest surprise to me is that the New England Patriots defense is historically bad. You know, and I, you know, stacked up the last 10 years. And it's 320 defenses, 32 times 10. And, you know, this is a bottom five defense statistically. And you can go conventional stats, you can go advanced stats. Mm-hmm. That's worse than I expected. I mean, I think we all realized there were some potential issues, but I didn't expect them to just be terribly, horribly bad where they have to score 30-some points to have a chance to win even at home. And mm-hmm. then the second biggest surprise to me is that, you know, Miami's not just struggling on offense, but like 0 points struggling. Zero points against the Saints struggling does surprise me a lot.
Do you think it's fixable? I mean, do you think of those two problems that one of them is more likely to, you know, go back to the expectations we had before the season by the end of the campaign?
Yeah, to me, there's no way the Patriots will be that historically bad on defense the whole year. I think that, you know, I do wonder, can they make enough progress on a short week on the road this week? I mean, I could see them losing to Tampa or having a tough time defensively to Tampa, but I think that you have to trust that their players aren't that bad and their coaches are good enough that they will improve, and maybe they would just improve anyway. It's hard to be that bad. So I think that improves. And, you know, the Dolphins are going to improve. If you look at last year, what happened was they started running the ball, and, you know, they fixed their offensive line combination. They found a better combination. I think what's really interesting about them is you're in the second year with a coach who really could do no wrong last year and had a lot of mojo this year, really seemed to have things rolling. And then at the last minute, you bring in Jay Cutler and pay him $10 million a year. That is not part of anyone's plan.
Right.
And when you do that, and in week four, ESPN's putting pictures of Jay on TV with a cigarette in his mouth. Did you see that on TV? It was very funny. I mean, after he did the Wildcat non-route running thing, they show him like talking to a coach, and they superimpose a cigarette in his mouth. So he looks like he doesn't give a you-know-what even more. You know, it was just, and I've been in these locker rooms where, like, ESPN's playing in the locker room, and I just, that's just a weird deal in the second year of your program when you're trying to do things the right way and you're being strategic about your moves. Let's just throw Jay Cutler in at $10 million a year at the last minute. That's weird, and I don't know what's going to happen.
Do you, with hindsight, do you think it would have been better to just stick with Matt Moore, and do you think there's going to come a point where if Cutler continues to struggle, it will be Matt Moore? Even though, granted, Adam Gase did come out and say that Jay's not the problem with the team, is there a point where you just make a change for the sake of trying to spark something out of your offense?
No, I think I would have. I think that I wouldn't have wanted to try to say we're going to go 16 games with Matt Moore. I think he's a nice replacement in the short term and has shown that a little bit. But I think Cutler made sense for the fact that, for all the things you don't like about him, he's been at least sort of an average to below average starter. And the fact that he could come in at the last minute, run your offense and know exactly what you're doing, I would have rather brought him in and see what happens and have it go wrong than to have not even tried and just go with Matt Moore or, you know, they could have signed Colin Kaepernick too. I mean, would you wanted to have gone that route? I think I would have probably gone this route too. And then if it doesn't work, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, I think I'm someone who I think, you know, I've written about Kaepernick, and I do think he is certainly worthy of an NFL roster spot. It's hard to imagine, of all the places in the league, Kaepernick's stance on Fidel Castro probably precludes him from going to play for the Dolphins, even though, you know, you could see a situation where he would be useful in that offense. So that's the one spot.
That's true, 100%. I think they weren't going to do it because of that, too. But,
yeah.
You know, at what points do you need to do something?
Right. So we'll see, yeah. I mean, it's going to be a really interesting spot there. The AFC East is a really fascinating division through 4 weeks of the season. Elsewhere on ESPN, you wrote a column this week that I thought was really interesting and perpetually a very interesting piece on possible NFL trade candidates.
Yeah, I did, and it was kind of a fun one. You know, we have still the rest of this month, and I think even though we saw an uptick of trades during training camp, I think during the season they're still probably driven by desperation. So we're going to see if some of these moves, you know, some of these guys who could be available actually get traded. And it's funny, the prices that I put in the column seemed low to me, but maybe they go higher as teams' needs come up, and suddenly it's like, shoot, we have to make a move for, you know, whoever. Is there a pass rusher that you know, a struggling team needs to add, or a running back? I think we see some running backs available, you know, potentially available, or at least in the margins of their team. I think Jeremy Hill is an interesting one to look at if somebody needed a big young back with some potential. T.J. Yeldon, some of those guys. Everyone will talk about Adrian Peterson. I just don't know. I don't know who wants to add that.
Yeah, that's the really interesting one, is that you think about Peterson, and obviously it hasn't worked with the Saints so far, and people could have saw that before the season, perhaps. I was someone who, you know, I did think that there was a possible fit there, that there might have been more, you know, might have been more on the bone with Adrian Peterson than it seems certainly so far this season. It hasn't worked, whether it's a, you know, a scheme fit, whether it's a style fit, whether it's a culture fit. It's hard to say, but it does seem like he's playing a very limited role in that offense. And the Saints certainly, you know, are probably better off relying on Sean Payton and Alvin Kamara and moving on from Peterson. But you think about where the market is for him, and you mentioned all those other running backs, your T.J. Yeldon's, your Jeremy Hills. It's hard to really believe that Adrian Peterson is a significant upgrade on those guys right now, and they're going to be cheaper, and they're going to be younger, and possibly have more upside for you after the season. Whereas with Peterson, there's not really, you know, who does he even make sense for at this point?
Well, not only are you adding, I think with Peterson, you're adding someone who's really used to being the guy, and when you're there's potentially a parallel to Kaepernick here in that these guys are used to being starters, but they're also guys that you build your offense around. You change what you do because of them. And with Adrian Peterson, you're going to put up with the fact that he's not a big factor in the passing game. He's not, he's a guy that to really make great use of, you need to just pound him and run the ball with him. Is he good enough at this point in his career to run your offense around him? And then when he gets four touches in the game that you're behind in all day, you got to deal with him staring down the coach and talking to the media about it. I mean, I just don't know that he's that at this stage of his career.
Yeah, there's just not a lot of teams who need running backs. And you think about, like you said, that the guys who are available, you could even think about maybe someone, and I brought up a couple guys who might be possible trade candidates I want to ask you about, and I'll start with them. I mean, someone like Frank Gore, who can pass block, who is on a team that's going nowhere in Indianapolis, whose career's wrapping up. You know, if he were available, you would think that would be a better fit for a team looking for a complimentary back than someone like Adrian Peterson.
I know, and I was I went over to the Seahawks-Colts game on Sunday night, and I was down on the field in warm-ups and just watching him go through his routine and thinking, God, what must he be thinking? You know, he's used to coming into that stadium with a stacked 49er team, you know, knowing they got a chance to win, and he almost deserves better. I've always just loved how he plays, loved how he approaches the game. But at the same time, even for a contending team, I mean, you're almost doing him more of a favor than you. I mean, is he going to come in and just change the equation? I suppose he could, but you'd have to be injured to do it.
Right. You're looking at maybe someone like the Ravens, who do have some injuries on offense, has some injuries in the backfield. You know, not that he's necessarily better than Alex Collins. Maybe he's a little more reliable of a player. Maybe someone who can give you, like I said, you know, a few reps not only as a runner but also as a pass protector. But again, it's not. You're looking at guys who are going to be getting traded for sixth or seventh round picks. Are not going to be major differences here. Someone who came up in the news this week and who was benched in Chicago was Mike Glennon, who may be a little unfair given some of the circumstances so far this year. You know, it maybe if I think it was Josh Bellamy dropped that touchdown pass in week one, that would have had Glennon beating the Bears. Maybe he has the Bears and the Steelers as wins on his resume. Even though he didn't really play especially impressive in the Steelers game, maybe that's enough for him to keep his job, but he's lost it to Mitchell Trubisky. Is there a team in the league where they might want to, if the money can be made right, you know, have Glennon on the roster as a high-profile backup or as an injury fill-in at starter?
Injury fill-in, yes. If somebody were to lose their starting quarterback and need somebody to go in, I could see, you know, desperate times, desperate measures, you got to bring them in. But, you know, these teams, like Jacksonville was willing to go into the season with Blake Bortles and no backup. They're willing to do that. So how much are they going to give up, you know, or pay to wedge in Mike Glennon, who, by the way, has turned the ball over a lot? You know, I agree with you that he was set up to fail because they don't have any weapons. And I agree with you that if in the first game against Atlanta his guys catch the ball and they win, maybe it buys him another week. But he's also just had a hand in too many turnovers this season. That was the one thing he couldn't do. In their formula for being competitive, there's zero turnover tolerance. They have no margin for error. So, you know, that's ultimately the big disappointment for him. And Trubisky, if he goes in and protects the ball, they're going to have more success.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just not many teams out there who are in a competitive space where they think they have a shot at winning who would probably be willing to make a serious investment in Glennon. You think about maybe, I don't even think this is the case, but maybe if Sam Bradford is done for the year, maybe Minnesota thinks about it, but they're getting Teddy Bridgewater back. Elsewhere, there just aren't that many teams who have quarterback injuries who would be a logical place for Glennon to hop in. So it does seem unlikely. What about, and this is someone who his free agency has gone awfully since arriving in Cleveland, is Kenny Britt, who would have been benched last week were it not for the fact that the Browns just don't have many healthy wide receivers at this point.
Yeah, I mean, does he excite you to? You know, to bring in somewhere. I mean, I just maybe he wasn't on my list because, you know, because he sort of bounced around and I know he's got the measurables, but yeah, he'd be a late round pick too.
That's the thing is that I mean, even you think about someone like. The Patriots are a team that makes a lot of trades and have taken some shots on guys before who maybe don't fit into your perception of what the Patriots culture is like, but there was probably more upside there in a lot of cases. You know, when they were adding Chad Johnson, you know, the upside was, okay, well, Chad Johnson's a possible, you know, a franchise player or wide receiver if everything works out. Clearly it didn't. He was pretty mediocre that year, but you get the idea. It just...
They'll make a move, don't you think? I mean, New England's going to. I don't know if it'll be significant, but I think while it's a good point to raise because while we're all preoccupied with them allowing, you know, 6,000 yards a game and what's going to happen on defense, you know, Julian Edelman's loss. You know, if Julian Edelman had been hurt 2 weeks ago, we'd be talking about their need for a receiver even more.
Yeah, for sure. And you brought up actually someone I thought who might make sense for the Patriots in your column, and Aaron Lynch. And you had someone in the league say basically, hey, you know, it just doesn't seem to fit their culture. And, you know, like I said, with if Lynch maybe had more upside, they'd be willing to give it a shot. But it does seem unlikely given that, you know, they need top-tier talent at defensive end, and they don't really have anyone who's a top-tier talent available to them right now.
Yep, they're going to have to manufacture it. And I wonder, too, you know, they just... It just seems to me like they should be, with their talent on defense, even without having a dominant rusher, they should still be a top 20 to top 25 defense. And if they're that, I think they're fine. I think they're dangerous, and that's fine. They just can't be 33, and that's what they are now.
Yeah, I mean, they're the lowest of the low when it comes to the defensive side of the ball. Do you think they consider any trades of veterans out? I mean, last year they did trade Jamie Collins in midseason, and it didn't really make a lot of sense at the time. You kind of figured, okay, well, you know, they're kind of moving up the schedule for their comp pick, and it does seem a little unlikely, but, you know, they won a Super Bowl. It seemed to go okay for them. Do you think that they could be in the market to trade any of the players off their roster right now?
Well, you know, what's changed on the Malcolm Butler front? You know, when he was talked about before the season, would they decide to do a Jamie Collins type deal during the season? And can you even entertain that when your defense is playing as bad as it is? They have more than other teams kept the long-term strategic interest of the team in mind when they've made deals, and they didn't always make sense at the time. You're like, oh, are they getting rid of Chandler Jones? I mean, they'd be better with this guy on the team for now, but that hasn't stopped them in the past. And so, you know, would a Jamie Collins type deal involving him be something they could stomach in light of where their defense is now?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine that they're in a better place to make a trade on defense than they were this time last year. So that makes sense. I mean, there's definitely going to be something you'd figure, but maybe not a ton on the trade market, barring something totally unexpected, which, you know, could happen, but seems to be more of an offseason proposition than a on-field proposition during the NFL sort of calendar. We're going to hit a break. We're going to come back with more Bill Barnwell Show here in a moment. But first, guys, I've got some interesting facts for you here from the folks at Gillette. Did you know the tip of a Gillette razor blade is measured on an atomic scale? It means their blade edges are thinner than a single brain cell. And that precision, well, it's the work of many brain cells. The hundreds of members of Gillette's research and development team have spent over 4,700 years combined, working to make your shave closer and more comfortable. That's longer than the Egyptian pyramids have been around. And while over 1,000 craftsmen and women in Boston are busy making your blades, another team is putting your blades through more than 60 extremely strict and precise quality checks. Fail just one of these tests, and it does not leave the factory. In other words, the hardworking people at Gillette never stop working to make your blades better. And now, that includes the price tag, because you can get Gillette blades at their lowest prices in years. See for yourself at GilletteOnDemand.com. Gillette, the best a man can get. Pricing applies to select products and is at the sole discretion of the retailer. All right, welcome back to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. I'm joined by ESPN's Mike Sando. We are talking about the first quarter of the NFL season, recapping that, looking forward to the remainder of the campaign and what the first quarter has told us about the season. And one way in which it has impacted things, something I tweeted about last night, which I wanted to get to with you, the playoff shifts in terms of the playoff odds between, according to the ESPN Football Power Index, between what we expected before the season and what we have through 4 weeks. Some of the teams we got to earlier, but definitely should get to some more of them now. So let's start with the positive side. Let's start with an optimistic view of things. The five teams who have improved their playoff odds most dramatically after the first 4 weeks of the season. According to the Football Power Index, it is the Buffalo Bills at 39.9%, the Chiefs 39.6%, the Lions at 35%, the Jags at 33.4%, and then the Eagles wrapping it up at 32.8%. So they're now 40% before the year for the Eagles now, 74.7. So it's actually 33.7%, excuse me, in terms of their chances of winning the NFC East. So, Mike, of those five teams, who seems most surprising and maybe most interesting to you?
Well, I think the Lions are the most one of the most interesting teams in the league to me, because really? when you look at their defensive personnel, I don't think you feel like it's just off the charts great. But mm-hmm. when you look at a team, like if you look at since the start of last season, if I said, hey, name the teams that have held their opponents to 20 or fewer points the most, you might be right in getting the Chiefs at 13. You might mm-hmm. guess the Vikings at 13. You probably wouldn't say that Detroit would be tied with the Seahawks and Broncos and the Steelers and Patriots and the Cowboys at 12 games.
No.
And
I wouldn't.
I think they are a fascinating team because they are like playing complementary winning ball. And what mm-hmm. I mean by that is, since Jim Caldwell got there, and I know that it was a switch to Jim Bob Cooter that really seemed to be the catalyst at offensive coordinator, but Stafford doesn't turn the ball over much.
Yeah.
It's very similar, if by the way, to what happened with Peyton Manning after Jim Caldwell came to the Colts.
Really?
And that when Jim Caldwell was hired, I was asked to do a column, is this a good or bad hire? And I called two guys that I know, Bill Polian and Brock Heward, who were there in India, and they kind of sold me on the idea that Caldwell's a great influence, that Caldwell's a great calming influence, that Peyton Manning's turnover problems kind of went away. Then it could have been, I mean, look, Peyton Manning didn't need Jim Caldwell to be a great quarterback. I'm not saying that. But it's interesting to me that Matt Stafford almost never loses the game anymore, very rarely.
Yeah.
Defensively, they're not great, but they play really hard, and they don't give up a lot of points. And part of that is their offense doesn't put them in bad positions. So they're this sort of this team that hangs around. They're a tough out, and late in the game, Matt Stafford can win the game.
Yeah,
so I mean, that makes them really interesting to me.
Yeah, there's a lot of things.
He doesn't break his finger last year or whatever happened. They mm-hmm. may win the division. They probably win the division last year.
Oh, that's right. He did break his finger. I forgot about that. That's true. And he did decline a bit after the injury, from what I remember. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, yep. but I do remember that his numbers did drop off a bit.
He, he had a harder time just winning the game. So, it's, you know, you and I would be look at them last year and say, oh, 8 fourth quarter comeback wins. I mean, that's just, that's going to regress. You don't do that every year. But the guy who did that is the guy who does that a lot.
Yeah. And even if you don't
like
have
Matt
8.
Stafford can do it.
Even if you don't have 8, you could still have 4 and still be good. And they're playing a lot better than they did last year in terms of their performance across the field. They should be 4-0. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not like last year where they were pulling games out in the last second. The one game they've had this year that went to the last second, they lost. And in some would say unfair fashion or frustrating fashion. I don't think they were, you know, by the measure of the rules, yes, they did lose. But it did seem like it was an unfair outcome. And certainly if it was on their foot, they would have won the game. Their defense is really fascinating, like you mentioned, because they do play a very slow pace in terms of games. They face fewer drives than just about anyone else in the league because their offense is so effective and so methodical and doesn't turn the ball over. So they don't face a ton of drives, which does decrease the numbers, but they're 4th in points allowed this year. I mean, no matter how many drives you're facing, you're doing something right if you're allowing 70 points, 17.5 points per game. And they're getting a lot out of guys who you would not have expected much out of before the year. Anthony Zettel, who was an anonymous defensive end, has been great so far this year. He's been better than Ziggy Ansah, who had that one great game against the Giants, but I think that was more about the Giants' offensive line than where he's at in terms of his health and his ability right now. He's definitely not 100%, but Terrell Austin does a great job of getting a lot out of his players, and their defense is much improved this year. And so now, you know, they don't need to be coming back with fourth quarter comebacks to win games. They can hold on to a 14-7 lead and hold it for the most of the game like they did here. They took the lead in the third quarter and then held on to it for the final 24 minutes of that game last week. So they can definitely win those sort of games, even if the luck isn't there to the same extent that it was last year. So I'm definitely surprised by them so far this season.
Now, one interesting thing about them is this sustainable? So last year, they were 31st in the league, only better than the Browns in points off turnovers, okay? So last year, they had 28 points off turnovers. The league average was 64. Denver was the high at 117, okay? Well, you flash forward, plus 28 last year. Through 4 weeks, they're plus 47. Points off turnovers is 47. It's not a differential. It's not a plus minus, but it's 47 points off turnovers. It's number one in the league. It's tied with the Jaguars. So, you know, is that realistic necessary? They're going to get so many turnovers and do that the whole year? No, it's not. But maybe they're going to just have a better year than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
not be 31st. Maybe they're going to be 10th.
Yeah. And they've done so much this year that even if you figure, okay, well, they're not going to recover a bunch of fumbles like they did against the Vikings, or they're not going to get 2 tipped interceptions like they did against the Falcons, they're still going to be holding up on defense, still making plays. Anyone else in that top 5 with the Bills, Chiefs, Lions, Jags, and Eagles who surprises you so far in terms of where they are so far this season?
Yeah, I think the Bills, you know, before the season, I predicted all 256 games, and so I went back and kind of was looking, and it's not like the Bills. I think I might have had the Bills at 2-2. I had them winning at home against Denver. I don't think they were going to be terrible. Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly going to Atlanta and winning the game and having their defense play as well as it has been a surprise. And I sort of lumped them in as one of those teams before the year that seemed to be tanking it. You know, that you're getting rid of Sammy Watkins, you really were bereft of any weaponry. You know, they had a couple decent players to catch the ball, but no one who was going to scare you.
Right.
And so for them to be instantly more competitive and to look like they're really good on defense, you know, is that going to be sustainable the whole year? I don't know. But I think that McDermott comes in with some credibility with what they were able to do. Granted, they're really good talent on defense in Carolina, but there were also years where it didn't look good for a while, and they had to patch together the secondary, and they made it work. So, you know, as much as they were tanking, they did go out with purpose and get a safety that he really liked. And, you know, I think that they were probably not crying to lose Stephon Gilmore, and they've made the most of it. And so they're better than I thought on that side of the ball, more competitive than I thought.
Yeah, me too. And I think it's maybe an indictment of Rex Ryan that, you know, he took over a defense that was, I believe, second in DVOA under Jim Schwartz, excuse me. I couldn't think of his name. I kept thinking Jim Caldwell. And there's more than one Jim in the NFL. And they were in the mid-20s in terms of DVOA while he was there for his couple of years. And now with Sean McDermott there, with Leslie Frazier there, they are again in the top two in DVOA before the Falcons game. And I think they'll probably be number one after the Falcons game. And it's not a defense full of stars. I mean, you have Marcell Dareus, but he's been hurt. He only played, I think, 28% of the snaps last week after coming back from an injury and missing a game or two. Shaq Lawson, their first-round pick from last year, was out last week. They traded away Reggie Ragland, who didn't fit in their scheme. They lost Raymond Humber to an injury. EJ Gaines went down to an injury last week. I mean, it's not a team full of, you know, top-tier talent in some ways in defense, but they're getting a ton out of a lot of guys. They're well coached. They don't give up big plays. And Tre'Davious White, their rookie first round pick, has been really good. Maybe one of the better cornerbacks in football. Which for a guy who went at the bottom of the first round, rookie cornerbacks are generally a disaster. It is really promising to see that kind of pop up so quickly into his Bills career.
Yeah. You know what it reminds me of, Bill? Which, by the way, I had to read that twice in your column about how it. With the Rex Ryan thing, how it went from that great to that bad to that great again. That was really stunning. But when I look at them with McDermott and sort of the juice that McDermott has early, I mean, he's really they've really given him, you know, a lot of power. I see potential parallel to Mike Zimmer. And Mike Zimmer, when he first came in, you know, they drafted some, you know, they drafted what, Harrison Smith? Did they draft Harrison Smith? I believe so. Yeah, and Anthony Barr, right? I mean, they basically let Zimmer pick some pieces for that defense, right? And if you look at those pieces, I think, you know, it's a really good defense sort of in his image. And there were a couple guys that were there already, certainly. But when I see Sean McDermott, you see somebody who, like, when they got Kurt Coleman, who's not a great player, he put him in his system. He made it work, and the guy had 7 interceptions 1 year.
Yeah.
So you see a history of somebody who is able to go to the grocery store, see the ingredients he wants, put them into his stew, and make it taste good. Mm-hmm. And when you look at, Micah Hyde, right, had the interception in the game the other day, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You Me see too. You, when you see the first round or the draft pick they bring in. When you see those guys hitting and it's the guy the coach wanted for sure and they hit right away, I think that's really encouraging and something that isn't by accident sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. On the flip side, I hate to do this, but on the negative side of things, the teams whose playoff odds have declined the most through 5 games, let's get to them very briefly. The Giants, 37.3%, have the biggest fall-off, and the Bengals, 31.3%, the Cardinals, 30.4%, the Los Angeles Chargers, 27.8%, and then the Indianapolis Colts found it running out the bunch at 25.9%. Of those five, whose drop-off has been most surprising to you through 4 games?
You know, what was funny when you were reading them through is, like, the reasons for all of them were coming right to my mind. I mean, so the Giants, you know, everyone's panicking on. They played 3 of their first 4 games on the road against the Cowboys, Eagles, and Bucks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of those was really distressing. But the Eagles game's a 50-50 game. The Bucks game's a 50-50 game. I know they had to come way back from way back, you know, with 20. They have 24 fourth-quarter points in one of those games. Mm-hmm. But, you know, their problem is they needed to win a couple of these in a very competitive division.
Yeah.
And that's why their odds are down. But I think that, you know, when you play 3 of your first 4 on the road, it's tough. Cincinnati, for example, starts the season against a really tough division opponent for them. I mean, Baltimore's going to play Pittsburgh and Cincinnati. Those are going to be tough games where you're not going to score a lot of points. Mm-hmm. They play Houston. Well, Houston just put up, you know, just one. When Houston gets rolling, it's 57-14 on Tennessee.
Right.
So those were two games to start the season where their offense may not look good. They're trying to break in a couple of new offensive linemen. They've got young weapons that need time to develop. What do you expect? You know, you expect those guys to just hit the ground running and be like they were, and Eifert's missing, you know, key parts of games for them. Mm-hmm. I think you just go down the list and you can explain almost every one of these. The Chargers are just the Chargers. I'm sorry. That's what they do every year. You know, they're going to tease you into thinking they're close. Mm-hmm. And they're going to lose the game 19-17.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, that's my burden to bear as someone who defends the Chargers from year to year. I'd like to think they'll turn it around, maybe be a little more lucky in close games, but it does feel like that is their curse. And certainly the unprecedented, perhaps, or maybe not unprecedented, but you think about maybe the Saints in their year outside of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, there just hasn't been a situation where a team has had such a, has had such a negative home field advantage or such a uncomfortable home field situation, given that, you know, their stadium, which is tiny, has been filled with other teams' fans for their home games so far this year.
Yeah. It reminds me, so I was talking to someone I know with the Chargers in camp, mm-hmm. and, you know, hey, how's the move going on? And he goes, you know, it's been awesome. It's been liberating. San Diego was it had become such a negative situation that everybody felt great about being in the new place and getting a fresh start. Now, this guy said, we're basically the same team we've been. You know, it's not like we're just suddenly way better from a personnel standpoint, but liked the feeling. Now, that was, I need to follow up with this guy because now they've had the home games and felt what it's like to be on the other side. But I think, you know, if one of those, you know, they've had a kicker who's probably a kicker, and then so I think some game management issues with a new coach and staff, mm. you know, that have probably deprived them of the chance to have a 2-2 record and feel better about things and maybe not have that home field thing be feel as bad as it does.
Yeah. I mean, but these were games they had to win or at least be competitive in, because now you look at their schedule over the next, after the next 4 weeks before their bye, they're at the Giants, who are also in a need-a-win-to-save-our-season mode. They're at Oakland, who they might not have Derek Carr. We don't know yet, but even without Derek Carr, you'd figure the Raiders are going to be favored to win in Oakland. They're host Denver, who should be a ton of Broncos fans there. And then they're at the Patriots in week 8 before their bye. It's not crazy to imagine that the Chargers could be 0-8 heading into that bye.
I know. And, you know, what's just disappointing when I look at them is, you know, look at how many points they're scoring. I know against Denver, that's fine, and the Chiefs are tough. But they don't score a lot of points. They're 17 points or 10 points or 21. They're lucky if they get 24. I bet you if we looked at, you know, the most games under 24 points since the start of last season, which mm-hmm. I'm just going to do while we're talking here. We'll go start of last season. Final score of what's a good number, Bill? What would be a good fair number
for what? For games decided
for
by
points assuming. That you scored, you know, final team score. Let's just say 21 and under.
Okay.
Let's just go 21 and under. The most games with 21 and under. Chargers have 10, and it's in the top 10 of the league. Mm-hmm. They just feel like a team to me that despite having Phillip Rivers, just never. They seem to lose a lot of those games where at the end you feel like, shouldn't they have more points? Shouldn't they be scoring more than 17 or 20? It just seems.
They seems do tough feel like a me. Team that they get. They're less than. They're less than the sum of their parts. I never understood how that phrase worked. Are they less than the sum of their parts? They have so many players where you think, oh, this is a top talent at this position. If he stays healthy, or if he's on the field, he's going to be a star. And in some cases, they are, but they're either inconsistent, or they have injury issues, or they just seem to get less than that top tier talent would seem to indicate. All right, Mike. Well, I want to get talking about some head coaches who might be on the hot seat. But first, before I get to that, if you are an NFL team and you do have a coach, perhaps a head coach, a positional coach, a coordinator who is on the hot seat, and you're thinking about possibly replacing them, I have a recommendation for you. I'm not going to say go out and get that hot coordinator. I'm not going to say beg some college coach to come work for you. I'm going to say just go to ZipRecruiter. Because with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. You're not going to have time to spend hours posting it on different sites. That's a waste of time. You're a busy person, Mr. Executive or Mrs. Executive who's listening to this podcast. But ZipRecruiter, it's one click. It's easy. And once you do that, ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. I'm not positive. I can't prove this happened, but I do believe that there is a ZipRecruiter drone that notified Sean McVay that the Rams job was open. Again, can't prove it. I don't have pictures of it, but it does seem likely. And 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just 1 day. There are, you know, it's not going to work necessarily 20% of the time. There are certain teams who maybe made hires just off season where it hasn't worked out. Chargers looking at you. But most of the time, 80% of the time, you get a qualified candidate for your job in just 1 day. ZipRecruiter has an incredibly easy-to-use dashboard that lets you manage your hiring process from start to finish all in one place. And you can find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results for free. For free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. That's my last name. B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. Post your job there for free today, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Before the year, Brian Burke of ESPN wrote a column about certain coaches who would be on the hot seat based on his machine learning model. And number one on that hot seat, I'm not sure he's done anything necessarily to make you think otherwise, through four games, is Chuck Pagano.
Well, of course. I mean, just the idea that you come in and there's a new GM. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think, you know, Chris Ballard's going to just never want to hire his head coach? He's going to get a higher one at some point. And so with Andrew Luck being out, you know, I do think that it's a much better building. I think Pagano and Ballard get along really well. Mm-hmm. But if they just have a terrible season, you know, sometimes it's just time to start fresh and it's not even personal. So I would agree that is, you know, he's in a tough spot.
Mm-hmm. Elsewhere in that division, he had Mike Mularkey with a 72.8% chance, and I think Mike Mularkey's off to a better start. Sean Payton was at 66.4%, Jim Caldwell at 65.4%. Again, they've been pretty good so far. Bruce Arians, 65.4%. What do you think about the situation in Arizona through four games? I mentioned them as a team that did decline a fair amount in terms of their playoff odds heading into week five.
Yeah, I just don't see how the injury situation is going to allow them to get to where they need to go. You know, I think Marcus Golden gets subtracted. It was already tough losing Calais Campbell in free agency. I think hurt them up front. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got offensive line issues that are bad, whether or not DJ Humphries plays at left tackle. You know, then you subtract the number one player. I mean, if you would have said before the season, who can they name three players they can't afford to lose? Well, David Johnson is going to be in the top three easy. Yeah. Maybe he's number two or one. I mean, just the value of the quarterback position may make Carson Palmer, but David Johnson is probably their best player. And you know, he's not going to be there for most of the season or a lot of the season, at least probably half the season. So good for them. They want to, you know, they won the overtime game, but I just feel like it's tough sledding for them, and I wonder what happens if Carson Palmer and Larry Fitzgerald retire after the season. Mm-hmm. Like for me, it felt like this: they were in a position in the draft where they might have been able to take Patrick Mahomes, and then I believe Kansas City and Andy Reid came up right ahead of them, right?
Yep. Or trained just ahead of them with the Bills.
So when that happened, that could have shifted the future of the Arizona franchise, because if Mahomes is there, I think Bruce Arians may be there for the long term, and that's the gunslinger guy. He's perfect for Bruce, and maybe it regenerates things. If now you don't have him, and if at the end of this season Carson Palmer's on IR or Carson Palmer's just beat up, he takes a month to go to Hawaii and think about it, he retires, Fitz retires, starts the clock for Canton, is Bruce Arians at this stage of his career going to be there for the rebuild?
Yeah, it's
fair question.
Certainly a valid question. I still think Blake Bortles is their quarterback week one of 2018, but it's definitely, I don't know. I just think that's the logical fit in terms of a guy they loved before the draft when he was coming out. Certainly a guy who fits what Arians would look for in a quarterback. Of course, if the head coach changes, it totally changes things. Who knows what they're looking for in a quarterback. But certainly the solution doesn't appear to be on their roster right now. And a team that their two wins this year over the Colts and the 49ers by 3 points each in overtime, and then their two losses are double digits to the Lions and the Cowboys. And seems like they are, you know, a product of when they're facing good teams, they don't look especially good. And when they play bad teams, they are squeaking out victories, which is a bad sign given that they play the Eagles, the Bucks, and the Rams over the next 3 weeks, with two of those three games on the road. Could be tough sledding for them going forward. Trying to think what else. John Fox, 65%. Certainly doesn't seem like there is a ton happening there. It seems like it might depend on how Mitchell Trubisky performs. Just think about Fox possibly holding his job after this season.
Yeah, I kind of felt like he was in a no-win going into the year, because neither one of those quarterbacks I thought was going to be good enough to overcome the problems that they have on the rest of their offense in terms of weaponry. But I think there's a good chance that changes over. I would guess that Ryan Pace stays and gets to, you know, I think when they brought in Ryan Pace, he was a young GM and he was steered towards getting the, you know, getting a coach with silver hair, you know what I mean? Getting a guy who had been there before and could really be the veteran presence and the calming presence. But I would guess that he could get a chance to, you know, hire another coach if by the end of this year, you know, they're not, they don't have the record that a lot of times you need to keep your job.
Marvin Lewis in Cincinnati started 1-3. We talked about them a little bit before the break, but do you think that they have any appetite for moving on from their head coach, or is there going to be is there a bar they're going to have to hit in terms of wins for them to keep Marvin Lewis around, or is it just the whims of Mike Brown?
No, well, it's always the whims of any owner. We can never forget that, but I think that you know, the signal that Marvin Lewis is in big trouble is that he fired his coordinator after two games. I mean, I realized they were horrible, but it's two games. You know, that was a remember Buffalo did that last year. You don't do those things as a coach if you don't have to. I mean, after two games, you can fix it. Ken Zampezi's been there for like 13 years as a quarterback coach. You know, they know who he is. And if he had been there these last 2 weeks, you know, would they not have probably improved a little bit on offense? I mean, it was kind of a perfect storm of terribleness in the first two games. But to me, when you get rid of your coordinator that quick, it confirms that you're really worried and that, you know, the fire is getting closer. It's hot there. And, you know, are they going to be able to have they're probably not going to win a playoff game this year either. How many times can you just keep going back without ever winning one?
Yeah. Two guys who weren't among the favorites to lose their job heading into this season, who you wonder if they've done enough. You wonder if their odds have significantly changed after 4 weeks. Talked about the Giants, but Ben McAdoo, who looks overwhelmed in some ways. It looks like he's not really adapting to the weaknesses of his offense.
Yep, and I think that it's been very disappointing to see them become the team they've come, which has really no identity in the run game to balance things out for Eli Manning. I think that 2 years ago, Eli looked good in that system. You know, and you could see him getting to his checkdowns and just looking like he had a plan. And now it looks like a lot of times his plan is just to make sure he doesn't get punched in the face on every single play. That's hard. He's, you know, for anybody, could he do better with it? Yes, he could. Sometimes, you know, he's just thrown in the ground to avoid a hit. But at the same time, they've got nothing as a running team. And I think when you, I think that McAdoo is probably complicit in that, as the team is just sort of trended that way to where you're taking an Evan Engram in the first round when you've got nothing to help you balance out your offense. You know, unmistakably, they've become a completely one-dimensional team under an offensive-minded head coach.
Yeah. We'll finish up with this other coach. Hugh Jackson, where the Browns are not expected to be good this year, but certainly you would have hoped to see more signs of competence. They are 0-4. Hasn't been it particularly pretty 0-4. They did give the Steelers a tough game in week one, but I mean, beat comfortably by the Ravens in week two, blown out by the Colts in week three for most of the game, had a furious comeback to make it 31-28, but were never really in danger of winning that game, and then blown out by the Bengals at home. The Bengals don't look especially good last week. You know, the Bengals, their first win. Now, they have the Jets at home this week, and if they don't beat the Jets and they're 0-5, you wouldn't figure they're going to fire Hugh Jackson during the season, but if they get through this year and it's another 1-15, 2-14 season, do you have to wonder about whether they look in a different direction at head coach?
Yeah, you do. I think, you know, how you lose, if you're just not competitive and getting blown out by a ton, you know, most of the weeks, I think owners have a hard time stomaching that, and you have a higher likelihood of a change. But what did they expect? Mm-hmm. I mean, they've pared back. The fair criticism of them is they pared back their roster more than they needed to. And it all looked good in the paper. If you never had to have an actual season where you play games, they'd have a great 5-year plan.
Yep.
But you gotta try to be competitive in the meantime. And I feel like they went backward. They pared back so much that you can't make up for it in the draft. I mean, especially they had all those picks. I mean, how many of those would they have? 14 picks that one year in 16.
Mm-hmm.
How many of those picks are looking like they're going to transform the roster? You know, I haven't looked at it recently, but going into the year, week one, you might say one or two are going to be good players for them. Well, what good does having all those picks do for you if you're not hitting on them?
Yeah,
I don't know what do you expect Hugh to do? Their main quarterback moves were acquiring Brock Osweiler's contract and getting DeShone Kizer, who went 4-8 and got benched at Notre Dame.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy. And you wonder if, you know, they do make a change with DeShone Kizer, if they go to Cody Kessler, who was effective to some extent last year, but some of the moves haven't worked out. You think about Kenny Britt, the guy who they signed to,
and has been... Yeah, I feel bad for DeShone Kizer. I mean, what is he supposed to do?
Mm-hmm.
Be ready to just put it on his back and really lift his team up? He needs the team to lift him up. And that's what any young quarterback is going to do need, and that's what 20 quarterbacks in the league need more than they're going to actually lift up their own teams. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And he's just in a no-win situation. He was going to need an adjustment period anyway. It's just hard trial by fire when you don't have a good team around you.
Yeah, hope that Myles Garrett, who looks like he's plausibly going to return against the Jets this week, hope that turns things around, but it does seem like a rough start for the Browns, I should say, so far this season. I think that's it. Let's call it there, Mike. Thanks for coming on. Where can people check out more of what you are working on?
Great. Thanks, Bill. Keep up the great work. Love coming on the show.
Of course. Are you putting anything up this week at ESPN?
It's a good question. I'll have my usual League Insiders Picking Games on Thursday as my next one, and then I'm gonna make a trip down to the Rams this week and renew some acquaintances there. And that's one thing I'm doing this year is making some trips to teams during the week, just to sort of, you know, renew acquaintances and meet people and get a feel for buildings and those sorts of things. So that's my next one. And I must say, I planned that before they went to 3-1. I think they're intriguing.
That's good timing on your part. And you're on social media as well.
Yep. Sando ESPN. You can find me on, Facebook as well, and
awesome. Thanks so much, Mike. Have you back on later on during the season.
Great. Thanks, Bill.
All right, guys, thanks so much for listening to today's episode of the Bill Barnwell Show. We'll be back later on this week. Of course, I'll be on the Nickel Package tomorrow, talking some more NFL stuff, but thanks for listening. More podcast coming to your ears later this week.